It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. I'm Jay Pearson for Celeste Quinn today, and in this hour, we'll be talking about Destination China. Destination China is a project of the University of Illinois Department of Journalism, and WILL is involved in it, as we are on an annual basis, to produce a radio documentary based on travels, learning, reporting by students in the Department of Journalism, and in this case, 8 undergraduates, 2 graduate students who went along with our news director, Tom Rogers, and Professor Nancy Benson, the Journalism Department, to China to explore. And we're going to talk in this hour about what it is they were setting out to do, what they were setting out to learn, what they did learn, some of the other experiences that they came home with. And all of which you can read about on their blog site, which has been in action since they left, and you can link to that from our website. And joining us in the studio, Tom Rogers, Nancy Benson, and Ted Land, who just received his bachelor's degree, just finished up his undergraduate studies here at U of I, and welcome to all of you today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I guess I'll start, Ted, since you were the student who was on the trip. With just an overall impression about what you understood you were setting out to do by taking part in this adventure.
I think before the trip, what I was expecting, I think what a lot of people in the class were expecting was, I mean, we heard the word communism associated with China, and we thought of this almost third world primitive country with barriers up around it, and it would be very difficult for us to get any kind of journalism done while we're there, and we were taking a risk by going here, and it would be dangerous. But it wasn't like that at all. Once we got there, it dawned on us within the first day, right away, that this was a very modern country with open people who are willing to talk about things that are important to them and that they want the world to know about them. And that became very clear to us very quickly, and it was very eye-opening for us.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy, was this along the lines of what you had envisioned as you were working to put the project together here?
Yes, it was. This is the second time I've done a course like this. I took students to Peru 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and then this time we went to China. And my goal is always to open people's eyes to what's going on outside the borders of the United States and to sort of get some context of what globalization means, mm-hmm. and how we are connected to these other countries and how they're connected back to us.
Perhaps taking some preconceived notions and either proving or disproving them.
Yeah, I think it's also a good way for people to confront their own prejudices or their own kind of ideas about another country or another culture that may not be based in reality. Mm-hmm. And so it's a way for them to sort of put themselves in this culture in a way other than a tourist would. A tourist is kind of, in some ways, going along the surface of a culture, and with the journalism students, they really had to dig into the culture. And when you do that, then you start to learn more about yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in many ways, this was the kind of the ultimate tourist experience because we went beyond tourism. Well, we did go to the Great Wall and Forbidden City and whatnot. We were in rural areas that tour buses never visit and, you know, saw things that make up what China is. We really got the essence of the character of this country that mm-hmm. you can't get just traveling there for fun.
In fact, I think the story that Ted did while he was in China is a very good example, too, of how our community is connected to China. And he did a story about electronic waste, so the computer parts and the printers and things that we discard here end up oftentimes in places like Taizhou, China, where Ted's story was focused. And
wow.
Maybe, Ted, you can explain a little bit about what those connections were.
Yeah,
right.
Ted, let's get to that in a second. I want to get an overall impression from Tom Rogers, as this was your first trip to China, too,
yeah.
and working with the students and thinking about ideas for the documentary that you're going to help them produce for July 28th that'll air on AM 580.
Well, actually, the ideas for the documentary began well before the trip itself. This is a semester-long class to begin with, and through most of that class time, there's been discussions about what types of subjects they'd like to cover, and then doing some of the advance work before going out to China, getting sources lined up once we're out there, getting sources here locally and elsewhere in the U.S., to talk to before heading out there, and lining up as much of the story as they can, and then going to China and finding out, what people think there, and how does this, where does the story go now that I'm there? You know, what angle does it take? What are some things that surprise me about the story? So it's been a learning experience the entire semester, and for me it's been a learning experience too. I've put together a story of my own when we were out there, and it's a new experience for somebody who hasn't really reported outside the United States. Mm-hmm. You get to really know what it's like to work around things such as a language barrier. This is a country where none of us really knew word one about Chinese, and to suddenly go there and work with translators to work with them to try to get their best interpretation of what your sources are saying, and to deal with that kind of logistical challenge is something that was new to me, as and certainly to the students too.
Well, let me give out our phone numbers in case you would like to join the conversation today at 333-9455. If you're calling locally, 333-9455, or long distance, 800-222-9455. That's 222-9455, long distance. And we're talking about Destination China today with U of I journalism professor Nancy Benson and Tom Rogers, our news director, who, along with graduate students, with John Paul, who is a familiar name around WILL, and Michael Kaliska as well, and eight undergraduate students, including Ted Land, who's in studio with us today, went to China, Beijing, Shanghai, and some rural cities around there to investigate what some of the important issues that we should be concerned about here might be, and what we should know about the business climate, about life, about the culture, in part, as Nancy, you mentioned, because of the globalization and the ties, the closer ties we have, not only business-wise, but also culturally. A significant Asian population, of course, in university communities like Champaign-Urbana. But Ted, tell me about your story. Nancy began talking about you discovered that there is electronic waste, old computer parts and things. Is that what we're end up from here in parts of rural China?
Right. There's the potential for discarded old computers, TVs, and electronics from the United States and from our community to end up in places overseas. Developing countries of the world is the route this trash stream usually takes. Lagos, Nigeria is one, but Taizhou, China is another, where I visited while I was there. People in this city, it's a port city, so all day long there are ships bringing in trash and electronic waste, auto scrap, and it's actually legal for China to import e-scrap, e-waste, into their borders. But it still comes in every day, and if you stand on the street, you can see trucks just driving it past. And where they're heading is to these outdoor scrap pavilions. It's a plant where people squat on the floor and pick apart the boards and electronics 7 days a week as their job. That's one side of the story. The other side of the story happens in the countryside outside of Taizhou, where people scrap electronics in their front yards and their backyards and inside their homes. It's a dangerous way to make your living because it's hazardous to your health, and it's also hazardous to the environment. Because they often dump the electronics in the countryside and in rivers and streams, and they burn them to get rid of the byproducts of this process.
Well, let me ask you, what kind of an impression did you have of seeing this firsthand? I'm not sure, have you ever seen stories about this kind of a thing happening before? Did you have any idea that this sort of stuff went on unchecked? It's kind of like, well, we know it happens, but it happens. You know, it's not supposed to, but it does.
And that's kind of the attitude the Chinese government takes,
right,
in relation to this. But I really didn't know about this until this past year. I found an article about it, and it sparked my interest, and mm-hmm. I decided to investigate it and kind of tie it locally into Illinois mm-hmm. to make it relevant for listeners here as well.
Okay.
But when I did get there, the latest I had heard about it was from an article that was – most of the work has been done in at least 2 years ago. There's not a whole lot of recent work, and a lot can change in that time because the government's starting to crack down on it overseas. So I really didn't know what to expect when I went there to see this. But I found that it was still happening, and it's kind of changing because they're pushing it out into the countryside even further. The people are kind of trucking the waste out, and they're doing the scrapping at night so that government officials can't see them doing it.
What kind of an impression does it have on you? And then we're going to go to our first phone caller. But what kind of an impression did it have on you to see this firsthand? What went through your mind when you actually saw people doing this?
Yeah, it was interesting because that was my first real experience seeing people. It was a very real experience, very eye-opening experience as a journalist to witness. And the people who are doing it, and they thought nothing of it. It was just their job, and it's a good way to make a living for them. But, you know, to come from the West, where that is unthinkable, to see them doing that in most people's minds, it was interesting to see kind of my interpretations of it compared to how people there feel about it.
Let's take a phone call at 800-222-9455. We also have lines open at 333-9455 if you'd like to join the conversation. But first on line four from Eureka, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Very interesting conversation. You're touching on the topic of computer waste from North America and other places going to China. It brings up a thought in my mind, and that is that many, many news stories on national news and, say, NPR and or the BBC seem to indicate that there is a massive environmental problem in China, such as the air quality, I believe, in Beijing and Shanghai is extremely poor, that the rivers have tremendous amounts of soil runoff and contaminants, the fact that China is... according to one statistic that is commonly bandied about, there's one coal-fired plant produced a week and other environmental conditions. Did you notice that when you were in China in terms of things like air quality or the quality of the water or any discussions or discussions you had with officials there?
Definitely. It's not an exaggeration. That's the situation there. There are days in, they call them blue sky days in Beijing. It's a day when you can see the blue sky. And there aren't many of them.
Another student actually is doing a story about exactly that topic. In preparation for the Olympics, the government has been taking measures. They've, for example, shut down some polluting plants around Beijing and actually moved them to more rural locations in order to cut down on the pollution within the city in preparation for next year's Olympics. And they're also talking about ways in which they may have to reduce traffic, because I think the statistic is something like 1,000 new cars hit the roads of Beijing every day.
I had heard on one news report that Buick now makes more in China from automobile sales than they do in the United States.
There were a lot of Buicks on the road in China.
I was struck by how many Buicks I saw there, and there weren't many other American-made cars, but there were a lot of Buicks.
Yeah.
I take it that the crowded conditions on the road in Beijing must be just beyond what one would believe in terms of what you thought of China before you went there.
Yeah, the expressways that ring Beijing, they're into a third and fourth and fifth ring road around Beijing. They're all six-lane highways, which I know in Chicago, when you go to a six-lane highway, it seems a little small these days with all the cars that are on them, but that's about as big as we saw. And yes, the congestion on highways was pretty amazing. It took long, long stretches of time to get to what
Thank
seemed
you.
To be not too far away.
That was one of the challenges for the students, is that to get from you couldn't do a lot in one day just because of the amount of time it would take you to get from one end of the city to another. It could take you an hour and a half
easily
to get to an interview.
Easily.
And Shanghai was the same way.
Yeah, and you can't schedule too many interviews if you're spending that much time just trying to get around the city.
Just sitting in traffic for hours. It became a daily experience.
Yeah. You know, we talk about when you go there and you actually see what it's like, and not to say that you've been to the entire country and that you came back total experts based on your
days on China.
But you talk about the population, and the number of cities in China that have more than a million people in them is multiples of what you would find in the United States, and it's probably very hard for most of us to imagine, unless we have traveled there, just how dense the population is. Is that the impression you came back with? Was it kind of awesome?
It is, in a way. I mean, when you're walking the streets, it's not like you feel crowded by people. It's not that kind of sensation. But when you go to a city like Beijing, you just can't understand the size of the city. It's something beyond anything we know in the United States. You know, their 20th largest city is the size of Chicago. So when you think in those terms, you can understand that when you're in Beijing, the city just keeps going and going and going. You just don't feel like you can ever get to the edge of it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And everywhere you go, it's high rise after high rise after high rise. So it's a very dense in terms of the construction.
Yeah, and they're all filled with – every high rise has apartments in it, and those are all housing for people.
Right.
These a sea of buildings that house people, these apartments everywhere. And that's where the population is.
And where you see, you know, the last multi-story apartment buildings, beyond them you see construction cranes with, you know, building 5 and 10 40-story towers beyond that. I don't remember what the exact figure was, but they said that 70% of the world's construction cranes, I believe, are in China at the moment.
Yeah,
and we counted a heck of a lot of them. You couldn't turn around in Beijing with seeing several construction cranes in any direction.
In Shanghai, I counted 10 looking outside my hotel room window.
Yeah.
I was actually wondering how many I could see.
Now, it's
but
not
the smog was blocking my view beyond that, so maybe there were more.
And it's not clear that all those buildings are occupied. I mean, that's the other thing. There are some shells out there, too. So I don't really know what percentage of the buildings that are actually constructed are occupied or what how long range they're looking in terms of the construction that they're doing now.
And even once you get out into the rural areas, I was able to go. I was about 8 hours away from Beijing is where my story was. And on the way there, you notice that, I mean, when you get out into the farmland areas, it's nothing like what we know here, where the population is spread out so thin, and there may be a house every half mile or so at times, and these large fields with nothing but crops. The fields are smaller, it seems, at least along the roads that I went through, and the housing is much denser even out in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
There are still very small villages, but there are lots of people packed into those small villages.
Wow.
One point, I just wanted to quickly make mm-hmm. one point, and that is it goes back to what Ted was saying about how this illegal waste is coming into China. And one of the points I kept making with the students, and one that I think I want to make now, is that I also was challenging them to keep a perspective on these stories. You know, it's easy to look at China and say, oh, it's a big polluter. But actually, the U.S. still pollutes more than China does. And it's also easy to say, well, the government sort of turns its eye, you know, when this waste comes in. But we aren't doing anything to stop the export of that waste. So those ideas also have to be contained in the stories. It's
right.
Not just China that we're looking at. We're also looking at China as it connects to the U.S. and what is our role in what's happening in China.
And an important point, because we're talking about this project, these reports that the students will be putting together for the documentary, of being, you know, what are the connections that we should be talking about. So I guess, Ted, you're going to be investigating that part of it. What about those, the United States or others, who are shipping this waste to China, cognizant, I would assume, of the laws of China, but still shipping it, China accepting it?
Right. It's more of a trade issue than anything else. It's export laws and import laws on both ends of the shipping route, China and the U.S. So the U.S. is one of very few countries that have not signed on to a convention called the Basel Convention that bans hazardous waste exports from major developed countries to less developed countries. Less developed countries are the only countries that will accept e-waste, because they're the only ones who will work cheap enough to scrap it, and they scrap it as they may to make a living doing it. So, but the U.S. has not signed on to that, so it's going to keep exporting this stuff until some kind of law comes in and stops them from doing that. But where else does it have to go? U.S. must build something up domestically, because it's an expensive and time-consuming process to responsibly recycle e-waste. So it's good. I saw a figure that there are 500 million obsolete computers in the U.S. today, I believe was the figure, and they have to go somewhere eventually.
And Ted, I think you mentioned also before that it's not just the U.S. where this computer waste comes from. It's still all over the world, and I wonder, you know, if there are even countries who have signed that convention, whether it's really stopped the waste.
Taisho, most of the stuff there was actually from Japan and Korea, mm-hmm. but there was stuff from the United States there, an increasing percentage.
Right.
333-9455, if you'd like to join our conversation, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Ted Land is a recent graduate of U of I. in the journalism department with his bachelor's, and now going to grad school or going to work, or what? Where are you headed?
Good question.
Don't know yet.
No, you know, this trip, I've been interested in going into local news, TV mm-hmm. reporting. It's been always been a passion of mine, and still is. But this trip, more so than I expected it to, really opened my eyes to the world and to opportunities beyond the United States. I mean, this is a huge story that's often overlooked in China. So, I mean, if I can find some way to get overseas and practice journalism, which I love doing, I would jump on the opportunity. I would not miss it.
Great.
That's one thing that we learned from. We talked to the people in the NBC News Bureau in Beijing. We made a visit to them. And one of the comments Mark Mullen, the reporter there, made was that, you know, they come out to China and they realize just how many stories there are to tell in the country and how many haven't been told and aren't that familiar to people in the U.S. It's amazing, you know, what stories you can bring back and what people don't know as well as what people mm-hmm. know.
Yeah, journalists in the United States like to complain because they can't find story ideas often. In China, that will never be a problem.
Yeah. Tom Rogers, our news director there, and also Nancy Benson, a journalism professor at U of I. And we're talking about Destination China. This was a project that took, in addition to Nancy and Tom, two graduate and eight undergraduate students from U of I to China, Beijing, Shanghai, rural areas around there, to investigate economic, political conditions there, and also to come back and produce stories that'll be in the form of a documentary and also contributions on the website, which you can link to from our website, will.uiuc.edu. Just look down the page and you'll see the Destination China link. Telling stories, the blog tells stories and sends pictures back, and there's audio of and video of what they found while they were there, and then the stories that they'll produce now. We'll talk about some of the important things that they think that we here in the United States, and Central Illinois in particular, should know about China and the relationship between the United States and China. We have a caller on line one right now from Royal, and you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hello. You mentioned the population in the cities being so dense. I was wondering, what do all those people do to make a living? What are some of their, you know, occupations? That can they all find jobs?
Well, that's a good question, because it did, you know, obviously, if some are taking on very hazardous jobs, like, you know, stripping used electronic equipment, there must be a need for jobs.
Well, increasingly, a lot of people are coming from the countryside who used to farm to move to more industrial areas to do factory jobs. E-waste scrapping is another one. So
construction
they can,
work.
Yeah, and they can make a lot more money in the developed areas doing that than they did back home farming.
And remember, China's manufacturing base is just growing by leaps and bounds. The amount of stuff that we import from China is just one, you know, gives you an idea of just how much manufacturing goes on there. And a lot of that's happening in and around, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, and the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. But is there great unemployment in these cities that you witnessed?
It's hard to know. It's hard to get a grasp on numbers because it's not easy to access mm-hmm. that kind of information from the government. What one student is doing a story on some of these migrant workers who do come from rural areas. And one of the things that she found is that there is this kind of registration system in China, so that where you're born is where you're registered to live. And you're not allowed to move that registration on your own. The government has to move that registration for you. So people often will leave family members back in that rural area where they came from. Maybe their spouse will stay there while they go to a city to work, because they don't have the same rights in those cities that they have at home. So they can't get access to education for their kids without paying for it. They can't get health care the way you would in the community where you're registered. And so they go away. Sometimes families are separated for the whole year, and the spouse will come back only at the Chinese New Year, where everyone goes back to where they were born, essentially, and celebrates with the family the dawn of the new year. And so oftentimes families are separated for an entire year while one spouse is working somewhere to make enough money to support the family, and the family farm is sort of kept up by the kids and maybe usually the wife, but not always. Sometimes it's actually the parents, and both spouses are maybe even in different cities, and their kids are being raised by one set of grandparents who are also tending whatever property they've left behind. So the family system seems to be kind of, well, it's not the sort of nuclear system that it once was. People are as they're migrating, the family system is also being disrupted by that process.
Let's take a call from Effingham. You're on the air on line four. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting. What you were just talking about kind of dovetails into my question, but I was just wondering what kind of access the group was given. In other words, I know it's a communist country. I know things are changing rapidly, but were you more or less free to come and go as you please, or did you have a governmental chaperone, or could you poke your nose into just about anything you wanted to, or did you have limitations? And I'll go ahead and listen off the air. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we went on tourist visas. We didn't use journalist visas. If you go on a journalist visa, it's a much more extensive process to get the visa. That we didn't, we weren't willing to go through all that, so we went with the tourist visa.
Plus, in order to, we didn't really qualify under the journalist visa. That's really for foreign correspondents who are based in China, who are affiliated with some news organization. Whereas this was a student journalism group. Mm-hmm.
But I had questions before we left. Could I hold a microphone in a public area and interview someone? Would someone, confront me about that? And it was never a problem. In fact, we shot a stand-up, a reporter on camera, in Tiananmen Square, standing on the square.
And no problem.
And no one thought anything of it. It was shocking to me. I didn't think we could have done that when we'd gone. For my story, I needed a government source and to tell me about what they were doing to clean up the kind of the situation there. And it was the last day we were in this city, and our team there, we were like, well, they're not going to talk to us. Of course they're not going to talk to us. It's the government of China. They're not going to talk to us about this because they don't want to talk about it. So we'll go to the office and we'll see what they have to say, and it'll be quick. They'll tell us no. We'll go home. Well, we went there and walked into the building and went up in the elevator and met some guy in the elevator and talked to him. And he's like, oh, yeah, come on into this room. Sit us down. The head of their atmospheric department came in there and talked with us for an hour. And we didn't set anything up. We just walked into the building, and he was more than happy to talk to us on the record. And I didn't expect that at all.
I have to say, too, we had a lot of help from University of Illinois alums who are back in China now working there. Most of the ones who helped us are Chinese. Mm-hmm. And everywhere we went, there was such affection for the University of Illinois and the opportunities that they felt they had gotten here, and they really wanted to give back. And so they would help facilitate access to people. They would help find sources for the students for their stories. They would go with them on the interviews and act as interpreters. So that kind of help was really, really important to this project.
Yeah, to get your way around, I would imagine when you face the language barriers and the like, it helpful to have people.
I was going to say one of the people that we had talked to because of the links with those alumni was a member of one of the Communist Party committees, one of the organizing committees. So, and they in cases where we tried to talk to them, they were willing to talk. And I had some of the same concerns as Ted did, and I know Nancy got several questions from me. What are they going to do if they see mics in our luggage? Are they going to be suspicious? Will they turn us around at the border? And as it turned out, that seemed to be pretty much a non-event. Customs was about as quick as any other customs I had ever been to
Very
in a foreign
efficient.
Country, strangely enough. They asked questions about bird flu. That's still a concern among the government there, and that's one of the questions they hand out in a health survey you take once you get into the country when you leave the plane. But other than that, it seemed to be pretty much a non-event, our presence there.
You'll hear in the pieces when the students get them produced and they are broadcast on July 28th that people were fearless in expressing their opinions, and very strong opinions in many cases. So people were not afraid to talk to the students, to be interviewed on the record with their names, so that was not a problem.
Yeah, it was almost easier doing journalism in China than it is in the United States sometimes.
Why was that?
Just getting sources who are willing to talk to you. That doesn't always happen here.
Do you feel like you got straight answers?
People don't want to make the time for you. Yeah, I did. And, it's easy to tell when someone's lying. And there were times when you could tell they were lying, but, you overcome that.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you up, but finding people actually willing to talk and then spend the time answering your questions was you think easier than you've had here?
Right. I didn't expect that when I was there.
I think sometimes that can have something to do with being American students coming over. Mm-hmm. I think Chinese journalism students trying to access some of these same people might have more difficulty than American journalism students who are trying to get at these sources.
And there are some subjects, I think, that may be a little more difficult to discuss with officials. Tibet,
exactly.
For example,
yeah,
the status
on the
of
topic.
Tibet, the Tiananmen Square movement from so long ago. We had somebody who was doing a story on you know, student political involvement and possibly apathy, and comparing that with Tiananmen Square. But there's still some unease in spots about talking about that.
Let's talk about the topics that the students will cover in the reports that you'll hear on the documentary that's going to be coming up, Destination China, which will air at 5 p.m. on the 28th of July, and will also be archived online, and I'm sure we'll broadcast it at least another time or two after July 28th, after its audition. But what were some of the topics? Ted, yours was specifically about the waste.
Electronic waste, the flow of electronic waste into China. Mm-hmm. Other topics included migrant workers kind of making their way to the cities and what their lives are like. Mm-hmm. And there was there were environment stories that dealt with the Olympics. What are we going to do in 08 with all the smog if you have to run a marathon in it? Soybeans was another story done by Michael Kaliska. Kind of how is Illinois playing into the soybean business over there.
And contrasting the life of a soybean farmer in Illinois to the life of a soybean farmer in China, which is pretty an interesting contrast.
A big business, especially with ethanol now coming into play.
Yeah.
There was Business in China done by John Paul. U.S. businesses outsourcing, and what are the benefits and the disadvantages of that? How does that work? Story about internet addiction by Christine Wan. Students in China, there are, I guess, kind of rehab facilities for students, for people, young people usually, who become addicted to the internet and, I guess, gaming and stuff like that.
Yeah, and her story explores a little bit about whether that is a real actual malady or real class, is it something that's diagnosed, or is that still another way that the government can sort of control access to the internet? That's one of the questions in her story.
That brings up another situation in which we did see some government intervention in things, that they do run a firewall where some things are blocked, where you can't when you get online using any Chinese servers, there's some sites that you will not be able to go to. Wikipedia is one site that they block because of perhaps the uncontrolled content that goes on Wikipedia. Some blog sites are blocked, but these are general sites. But even though we did feel a lot of openness in China, there are still signs that it is still an authoritarian government.
And you mentioned too, NBC mentioned the ways in which they feed their stories to somehow sometimes get around the government and the possibility of censorship.
Right. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, and we're online at WILL.UIUC.edu, and I assume that's where our next caller is listening to us, calling from Houston, Texas, on line 4. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Very interesting. I just heard you visiting Taizhou.
Yes.
Why you chose that place, though?
It's a major port city where a lot of the e-waste is happening and scrapping is happening. There's two places, and the other one is Guiyu. Guiyu, maybe.
Where's it located?
It's about Taizhou is about a 40-minute plane ride outside of Shanghai.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, what do you see from there? Because, I come from China. That place is very close to my hometown.
Right.
It used to be a very small town. So what do you see from there?
Yeah, it's a huge growing city. I mean, everything there is new. And it's an industrial city. That's what's making business boom there. They do a lot of plastic molding. The second you get off the plane, there's signs everywhere for businesses who need plastic molding stuff done over there. And I guess that's where a lot of them outsource that. But there's also stuff coming in that's making them money, and that's the scrap business, the waste business, coming right into the port and then heading into the city where people scrap everything.
Very interesting.
And you're from that, from close to there?
Yeah, I'm from there.
Uh-huh. How long is it? How long?
I have been here in the United States about 15 years.
Actually,
I went to University of Illinois.
Oh, you did?
Springfield. Yeah.
Oh, great.
I moved from Champaign, Urbana. I miss that place very much.
Have you been to Taizhou?
When I was very
recently.
Little.
Yeah.
I barely remember a thing, but
right.
To my impression, it's a very small town, you know. But no.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Apparently, time did quickly. Things change quickly.
Yeah. Another question. The Chinese government, they have only child policy. Have you seen the change on this?
That is another story student's pursuing. And that's also an interesting story because there are two ways she's looking at that. One is that some people believe that the children of the one-child policy are now very kind of pampered and that there's a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation put on them because there is only one child to support the parents in retirement. And so that's really creating a lot of angst for that generation. And the other thing is that because of that, women's role is the role of women in society is starting to change because the women are getting educated. It used to be their brothers would go off to school, but now if they're the only child, they're getting an education. And so that's changing how women see their place in society. They don't want to go back to their rural roots and help, you know, work on a farm. They want to be a lawyer or a doctor. They want to stay in Beijing or Shanghai and have this kind of urban lifestyle that they've become accustomed to. And so many of them are saying, I don't really want to get married. Or if I do, I'm not sure I want to have children. And I certainly don't want to go back to the farm and live my life there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Good.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you much for calling. And I hope you'll be tuning in for the documentary July 28th or listening to it online.
That's one angle about why this was such a great place to go is that there are so many people who come from China to the U of I to study, to teach. There are so many people who live in this area who are from China, and yet we as Americans know so little about the country, about the largest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many connections that you can put between the U of I itself and China.
Why do you suppose that is? Why do you suppose we know so little? Is it a matter of just there has been a problem with access in the past to information, to accurate information? Is that part of the problem? Is there another barrier? Is it a lack of interest on our part? Are we just lazy in that department? And is there a reason why we should be more interested?
I think it's a lack of interest on the Americans' part, but that's why our job as journalists is so important, to make them interested in it and make them realize how important this place, this region of the world is.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of the things that are happening in China are recent developments, just within the last 20 years or so. So that there hasn't been a whole lot of history. So maybe it's something along the lines of people aren't – it's just kind of crept up on us now, and now we're just now starting to realize how this story is exploding and taking off.
And keep in mind, you know, at the time when America was growing so much in the 50s and 60s and 70s, China was closed off to us. We couldn't go to China. We couldn't. There was nothing coming out of China.
Right.
There was a totalitarian regime. There was the Cultural Revolution, in which, you know, so many things were happening in China that we never knew about. That openness didn't really happen until 20 or so years ago. So there's a lot of catching up to do. That's, you know, it's maybe one reason why we don't know, you know, so much about it today. It's going to take some time.
Mm-hmm.
And even while we were there, we did have a news briefing by the Olympic Committee, a representative of the Olympic Committee, and he did point out that since January, they've sort of loosened the restrictions on the movement of media, professional media who are working and living in China. But it's likely after the Olympics that they might start putting some of those restrictions back in place. So right now there's an especially free time in China because it's preparing to present this face to the world, and they want the world to see it as this open and free developing country.
Yeah, it's kind of troubling that their legacy maybe will end up being that they were free for a year or so, they let journalists in, but after that we just went back to the way things were. It's kind of a step backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Because it used to be a journalist would need permission. They'd have to apply to the government and get permission to go someplace other than where they lived and worked. And now people can move more freely, but they're saying after the Olympics, it's not clear exactly what restrictions would go back in place. Mm-hmm. No one's being specific about that, but they're saying it's likely that some things will be tightened up a little bit.
So do you think in the next couple of years then it's a good opportunity and that a lot of work will get done over there? To talk about things that you might not be able to find out about?
I'll be really interested later to see how NBC, which is carrying the Olympics, mm-hmm. deals with that, yeah. because this is, you know, a prime opportunity for them as the station or the network that has the most access to go out and do a lot of news stories that they otherwise might not be able to do. And I'm curious to see if that happens or how it happens.
Mm-hmm. They'll be expanding their staff fairly soon, too, so yeah. we'll see.
We'll see. Ramp it up. Ted, are you going to be a part of that staff?
Hopefully. We'll see.
All right. We have just a couple of minutes left here on the program, so I thought we'd just take a moment to get your biggest impression following the trip. And, Tom, how about you first?
Oh, goodness. Not an easy question at all. I guess it's just going to a place where you know, the communication gap is something that you have to bridge immediately. Yet being able to bridge that gap in some ways that you didn't expect. dealing with people who don't know your language, you don't know their language, pantomime comes into play quite a bit. but just the differentness of it all, I guess, as somebody who's been to foreign countries were a little more Western. And the way that China has brought up, they have been in a totalitarian government before. Things have lightened up a little bit, and I think being able to see that at a time when things are changing was really, really, really important.
Mm-hmm. And was that a positive experience for you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And in addition to being frustrating sometimes, perhaps, of just trying to get around and do simple things.
You learn what you can do and what's possible.
Nancy, how about you? Well, that was Tom Rogers, our news director here at WILL, journalism professor Nancy Benson.
Well, this was, I think, my fourth time to China. So mm-hmm. for me, I think I was looking at it now from this other perspective of bringing the 10 students here and really hoping for the best for them. And I guess I was struck most by the openness and the access that we had, that people were so open and so willing to help us, and they were so willing to share their ideas with us. And just, it's a culture that prides itself on being hospitable, and you really felt welcomed and really felt a true exchange of ideas mm-hmm. with everyone that we met.
Mm-hmm. Great. Ted Land was one of the 10 students who was on the trip, just graduated from U of I Journalism School. And Ted, your impressions?
Well, Nancy stole mine, but that's okay because I was struck by a lot of things while I was there. And one of the things was just the sheer contrast. It's a city of a country of contrast where you'll be in a very modern metropolitan city with designer stores and Audis driving down the streets, but just miles away outside in the countryside, people are living in extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's why this is considered a developing country and a third world country, even though it has these huge multi-million person cities. There's such contrast there and between the wealth and the poor.
Mm-hmm. All right. And you will hear all of their stories coming up on July the 28th. That'll be the debut at 5 p.m. of their documentary, Destination China, and we will also have that on the web, and you can go to the blog that they created throughout the trip. Very interesting to read their observations as they were filing them from overseas at WILL.UIUC.edu. Our website, you will find a link to the Destination China blog site. Thank you all very much for coming in today and just scratching the surface on this. Yeah. And of course, by going to the blog site and listening to the documentary, everybody will learn much more about what you were up to and what you found.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's the Afternoon Magazine for today on WILL AM 580, at least this hour of it.